This is Day to Day. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Alex Cohen. There are hundreds of thousands of restaurants all over the world, but fewer than 70 of them have earned 3 stars in the famed Michelin guides. Andy Haler has made it a mission to eat at as many of those 3-star restaurants as he can. He joins us now on the phone from his home in London. Welcome to the program, Andy. And can you tell us approximately how many of these restaurants have you eaten at to date?
Well, I've eaten at all of them, actually. So there were, in 2008, there were 68 3-star restaurants, and in November I went to the last of those. Until the 2009 season kicks off, I've pretty much been to all of them.
And this has all been, we should note, on your own tab, flying to these places, eating at them. I can't imagine this is an inexpensive hobby. Might I ask how you are able to afford all of this?
I don't actually think it's an incredibly expensive hobby. I mean, if you compare it to, say, wanting to drive the best car in the world, you know, I think it's just what I've mostly spent my money on. And, you know, I live in London. I don't even bother with owning a car in London because you have such good public transport here. So I save some money that way.
Andy, you have dined all over the world. Can you describe some of your absolute favorite 3-star meals?
Yes, I think one of my long-term favourites has been a place called Louis Cannes in Monaco. It's on the French Riviera. That's a place with fantastic ingredients. You get tremendously good local markets there. Another one which might surprise people is probably the best meal I had last year. Was actually in Germany, and I think German food is, you know, you tend to think of it a bit like
sauerkraut
British.
And sausages and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's the best of times. It was the worst of times, you know. but they are serving French food, I have to say.
So wait, this was a restaurant in Germany, but they served fine French fare.
Yeah, and all of the 3 stars in Germany do that, and none of them actually serve, you know, sort of pig's lung and bratwurst and so on, I'm afraid.
You write a food blog, and you write about these restaurants you go to, but unlike other restaurant critics, you're paying for your own meals. Do you think that gives you a different perspective?
I think it does, and I think it means that I care quite a lot about value for money. Now, that may sound kind of strange for someone who's eating in very expensive restaurants, but it does mean that I, you know, even in the top places, I actually care about what I'm getting for my money, because it's my money. If you're being paid to go by the New York Times or whatever, you know, then, you know, you can go to someone like Massa in New York and spend, you know, I think it's $540 before you've even, including service, before you've even had a drink. And, you know, you can have that meal and think,
On what? I mean, well, I'm just flabbergasted.
I know, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's $450, you know, but there's 20% service automatic, and that's before you've had a drink. It's a sushi bar, you know, and that has 3 stars, and to me, it was ridiculously expensive for what it was. You know, when in Tokyo, I could also go to a 3-star sushi bar that was better, and that was $120, including drinks.
Andy, just curious, on days that you're not doing the 3-star meals, what do you normally eat? Do you keep up the kind of fine cuisine, or do you just kind of do sandwiches and hamburgers so you can really appreciate those good gourmet meals?
It's kind of varied. I do eat out about 5 days a week, but I also have to go to the gym 5 days a week to sort of try to pay for that. And no, on the other days, I mean, I'll very, very often, I'm very fond of Indian food, for example, which is a very strong thing in London, and very, very happy to go to little sort of, you know, cafes and so on, have, you know, fish and chips or something if it's good. And to me, it's all about whether it's good in its context, you know. So to me, you know, you can have really superb, say, you know, fish and chips or superb hamburger. Yeah, those are all, you know, to me, sort of equally valid as something that's, you know, it's very, very fancy.
The 2009 Michelin editions just came out. Are there any new 3-star restaurants that you're really excited about in the year to come?
Well, the one of them was Massa in New York, so I wasn't very excited about that, I must say, which I went to. I'm actually quite excited about one of the ones in Hong Kong, which is a Chinese restaurant, and that'll be the first 3-star Chinese restaurant, and that you know, could be potentially really exciting.
Andy Haler writes about food on his food blog, andyhaler.com. Thank you so much, Andy.
Thank you very much indeed.
If the Obamas have time to do any sightseeing, they could drop by a place that has been described as the most beautiful building in Washington's Federal Triangle. There are more than 50 murals on the walls. It's not the National Gallery of Art, or any of the art museums for that matter.
Welcome to the Department of Justice. We're delighted to have you here.
This is one of the Justice Department's most famous tour guides. Winifred Hart has been retired for a while now, but back in 1996, the Justice Department recorded her giving this guided tour.
I don't like to talk about the people next door, but they have perfectly hideous walls and not very nice ceilings.
As Winifred Hart put it, the Justice Department is loaded with symbolism.
We drip symbolism in this building. This building is a sermon, a hymn to justice.
If that sermon, if the hymn were purely predictable, it wouldn't be much worth talking about. Of course, the building has flags, eagles, scales of justice, everything you would expect. But there's also real art, dynamic paintings that were progressive, controversial, even radical in their time. For example, in the 1930s, the Justice Department installed a mural that showed black and white students being educated together. The art showed a dream that democracy had not yet realized. Washington, D.C. was still a segregated city. Virginia Mecklenburg is a curator from the Smithsonian American Art Museum.
The whole scheme of all the murals in the Justice Department was really a grand epic view of the role of law in American society.
The building was brand new. America was struggling through the Great Depression, and the country's most prestigious artists of the day competed to win commissions for paintings that would show how law and justice can make life better for everyone.
So these were going to be the shining stars that launched this program that they were hoping would put murals in post offices and federal buildings all over the country. It was a real initiative to take art to the American people, and not just people who were used to looking at art. It was a way to get art into the heartland of America.
One of the most arresting paintings in the building has a place of honor in the Justice Department. It hangs just above the main library, around the corner from the office where the Attorney General works every day. It's an anti-lynching mural.
There is a cowering or terrified person on the steps of the courthouse, with the judge coming forward from the court, standing off a lynch mob in bandanas with a flame of hate rising behind them.
Roger Kennedy is Director Emeritus of the National Museum of American History, and he used to be the Director of the National Park Service. He's writing a book called When Art Worked, and he was an attorney at the Justice Department in the 1950s.
When we worked here, we would show up here to go get our briefs together. We thought we were serving the cause of justice. And this thing said to us, it's not foolish or proud or vainglorious to think that you're participating in the noble work of American justice. This is what you're here for. Go to work. Do it better.
So every attorney at the Department of Justice going into the library to research a legal brief will walk under this image.
Yeah. Yeah, and you hope that it takes.
It really is striking. One would expect in a building like this to see images of America at its finest. We walk into the Department of Justice, and in the main library, there is an image of what might be considered America at near its worst.
Yes, absolutely. This is art really doing its work, and it tells us what our country is really like. And incidentally, it's inescapably us, not somebody else, not the founders, not the 19th century, because there, what illuminates the scene are two things: the flame of hate in the back and the car headlights in the front.
And it is only the judge that is holding that back from the man cowering on the steps.
That's right.
One man in the lynch mob wears a dapper linen suit and a hat. In the back of the mob, two girls are waving. They look like they're having a good time. The man holding the lynching rope has his face covered. So does the man cowering on the steps. It's as if both the hunter and the hunted could be anyone. When John Stuart Curry painted this mural in the 1930s, lynching was a serious problem in America. Curry submitted one sketch after another to the Fine Arts Commission, and the commission kept rejecting the sketches and sending them back, before finally settling on the design that now hangs over the library. Curator Virginia Mecklenburg.
There's this wonderful letter, a very nice letter, but a very firm letter from a man named Edward Rowan, who was essentially running the program at this, the mural program at this point, saying, you know, you're a terrific painter and we really like the ideas that you've talked about, but we can't accept these murals because we don't think they are your best work.
Tough words for one of America's top artists. Mecklenburg says there was just so much riding on these murals. They were meant to launch a program that would inspire America and give the country hope.
the Depression was awful. There were bread lines everywhere. And somehow to suggest that we really are a civilized society, and in the case of the Justice Department murals, everything having to do with law, that we can't slip back, that it would be terrifying if we lost, even in this dreadful time, we lost everything that we had achieved as we'd gone through the 18th, 19th, and 20th century to build the institutions that guide our lives.
Now, a new attorney general is about to go through confirmation hearings. Eric Holder is set to become the first black attorney general in American history. When he walks through the halls of the Justice Department, he will pass all these murals, reminding him that this is his story and ours, and that his job is justice. The Justice Department is not open to the public, so you can't see these murals in person, but we have detailed images of them at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President-elect Barack Obama is about to meet with lawmakers to push for his economic stimulus plan, but top Democrats warn it will not be ready for his signature in time for his inauguration on January 20th. NPR's Allison Keyes reports.
Mr. Obama has said his plan will create 3 million new jobs, mostly in the private sector. Some will involve rebuilding the nation's crumbling roads, bridges, and schools. The president-elect says the proposal provides tax relief to 95% of American workers and doubles production of renewable energy. This weekend, the president-elect used his audio-video address to urge Congress to take quick action on the plan, which is expected to cost in the neighborhood of $775 billion.
Economists from across the political spectrum agree that if we don't act swiftly and boldly, we could see a much deeper economic downturn that could lead to double-digit unemployment and the American dream slipping further and further out of reach.
But the second-ranked Democrat in the House of Representatives, Steny Hoyer, is warning that even if lawmakers move as quickly as possible, it may take weeks to get the plan ready to be signed into law. The Maryland Democrat told Fox News Sunday it is unlikely his party will push for a vote next week.
It's probably going to slip because this has been a complicated effort, a cooperative effort between the Congress and the incoming administration. And again, we want to do this right. We want to have people know what we're doing.
Republicans like House Minority Leader John Boehner have pushed for just that, calling for public hearings and more time to review the proposal. Hoyer says he hopes to see the package pass the House by the end of this month, get to the Senate, and then to the president's desk before Congress breaks in early February. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
Next, let's remember a man who led the U.S. Justice Department in the wake of a scandal. The scandal was Watergate, and the attorney general in the years afterward, some of the years afterward, was Griffin Bell. He grew up with President Jimmy Carter and became his attorney general in the late 1970s, and he has died in Atlanta. Bell was 90 years old, and Griffin Bell was one of those widely credited with restoring public confidence in the Justice Department after Watergate. Our legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg, is here. She spoke with him last summer, not long after we learned that he was dying, and she joins us now live. What made him a significant figure, Nina?
Well, you have to remember what the Justice Department was like in the wake of Watergate. The Attorney General had gone to jail for obstruction of justice, and he had sort of pulled the entire department, including the head of the FBI, into this massive obstruction along with the president to protect the president.
The definition of a politicized Justice Department.
The definition of a politicized Justice Department. We think we've just had a very nasty political scandal in the Justice Department, but nobody went to jail because of it, and it never reached into the presidency itself, or the attorney general has not been charged with any crime. But that is where we were then. And the first guy who inherited this mess was President Ford's Attorney General, Edward Leavy, who was an academic and sort of righted the ship. And then came Griffin Bell, who was a political figure in the sense that he'd always been involved in politics, but he'd been a judge for 15 years. And he was just a sort of a breath of fresh air and a ray of sunshine, and he sort of knew what his job was. And when I talked to him a few months ago, at the time that he knew he was dying, here's what he said was the task before him in restoring trust.
Trust is a coin of the realm. If the public doesn't trust the Justice Department, we're in trouble. So I think you have to be transparent. And so you need to let people know what's going on and who you're meeting with and who's influenced you, who's got a chance to influence you. And I took great pride in that.
Yeah, he did. What he did was he published his log every day, mm-hmm. the log of who he met with and who he talked to on the telephone, and he gave it to the press corps every day.
So you never had any questions about backdoor dealing, or at least fewer questions about backdoor
and
dealing.
And he said he had fewer calls from members of Congress.
Because who wants to have that publicized that they're calling the attorney general about something?
And it's so interesting that here is this guy who was initially, people said, oh, he's a crony of the president's, and he was fiercely protective of the career people in the Justice Department, brought them into the decision-making process on a routine basis. He did a lot of things that we take for granted today. He was a sort of a hawk, a hardliner on national security, but he was a fierce advocate for doing it within the confines of the law, wiretapping. And he fought off the CIA on that. He fought off and wrote the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which has been in place ever since until President Bush started circumventing
it. This allows wiretapping against national security targets, but only within limits and with the permission of a court.
He said there had to be a court, an independent judge overseeing
which gets back to that issue of trust and confidence in the system.
Absolutely.
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, thanks for coming by.
My pleasure.
And again, former Attorney General Griffin Bell, Attorney General in the Carter administration, has died at the age of 90.
Today is the first day back in class for lots of kids, including two little girls starting at their new school here in Washington, D.C. Commentator Patricia Elam is glad that if President-elect Obama has his way, his daughters Malia and Sasha will have some extra support at home. Mr. Obama has invited his mother-in-law to join the family in Washington.
Marion Robinson, the first grandma-to-be, from all appearances, possesses that familiar balance of no-nonsense tempered by large doses of love. I've peeped her standing protectively behind the girls. I watched her wordlessly take the president-elect's hand in hers on election night. Her face exuded the pride of a mother. She's not effusive with it, though, at least not in public. She knows her role, and she's done it well for many years, as evidenced by the remarkable children she already raised, the coach and the first lady-to-be. Many families, especially African-American ones, have enlisted grandmothers to help raise children, both out of necessity and out of sheer respect for our elders. Grandma, Nana, Grammy, Madeer, Big Mama, by whatever name necessary, they are often the family arbiters. We tend not to want to institutionalize our older folk, and many remain youthful and spry for quite some time. My teenage students constantly remind me I'm the same age as their grandmothers, several of whom are raising them. Others relieve parents who work during the day or at night. In many cases, they live in. I grew up with my paternal grandparents only a few blocks away. We spent time with them whenever our parents had meetings or date nights. My grandmother cooked the best fried chicken on Sunday mornings, a stereotype I know, but true and delicious nonetheless. And we knew better than to turn down her request for a command performance of a poem, dance, or song we had learned in school. I loved many things about my grandmother, her wispy blue hair, her funny stories about the old days and my father as a little boy, her bowl full of peppermints, and the fact that she went to bat for us on those rare occasions when our parents, sharp minds temporarily eclipsed by hectic schedules and long hours, had simply made the wrong decision. I bet the Obama girls can count on that from their grandmother, too.
Patricia Elam is a professor at Howard University and author of the novel Breathing Room.
Tomorrow, President Bush is expected to announce that he's creating three vast ocean reserves way out in the Pacific. They'll be designated as Marine National Monuments, and they will encompass more territory than the state of California. For a president not known for being an environmentalist, this is a significant part of President Bush's conservation legacy. Joining us to talk about this is NPR's Richard Harris. More territory than California? That's a lot of space. Where is this?
It absolutely is, and it's way, way out there. The first of these three spaces is the Northern Mariana Islands, which are north of Guam. So we're, you know, get to Guam and you're only beginning your trip out there. But this includes the Marianas Trench, which is the deepest part of the world's ocean. You could take the Mount Everest and put it into Mariana's Trench, and it would disappear under the ocean surface. We're talking a really dramatic structure. And that's one reason they're protecting it is not just because of the fish and so on, but it's just this amazing geological and geographical site. So that's the first one. The second one is closer to American Samoa. It's an atoll called Rose Atoll, which is apparently this gorgeous pink coral area that has got this, is really pristine and untouched and is just supposedly a fantastic place if you could, again, ever get out there to see it. And the third one is part of the U.S. Central Pacific Islands. Again, these are scattered over thousands and thousands of miles of the Pacific Ocean, and there's seven islands in total. And the idea is these marine preserves are sort of the first 50 miles of sea around each one of these islands, and the same is true of the other places. So yeah.
You've done such a good job of describing this. I can almost picture all of these areas. Two quick questions. Can the president do this with just the stroke of a pen, and what does this mean for these protected areas?
Yeah, the answer is he can. Teddy Roosevelt actually first used the Antiquities Act back in 1906 to create protected areas. And in fact, President Bush used the same act back in June of 2006 to create a similar reserve in Hawaii, somewhat smaller size. This is even bigger than the reserve he created in Hawaii. And he got such good response for doing that, he decided to do it again. And the answer is it's kind of like a national monument on dry land, which is they are protected. You can't extract stuff, by and large. There's
so
no commercial fishing allowed,
yeah.
And there's no mining allowed, almost. There are a few little potential loopholes for doing a little bit of fishing, but basically it's the idea is to really protect this for posterity.
So you said that President Bush got good marks when he did this near Hawaii. What do conservationists think of this?
They are generally quite happy with this because it vastly expands marine protected areas. The oceans are very underprotected compared with the land. Even with these huge additions to ocean protection, it's still less than 0.01%, or about maybe 0.02% of oceans are protected. It's tiny. One thing that conservationists notice is that he could have made these reserves go out to 200 miles, which is the federal limit, and he decided just to keep it to 50 miles. So there's certainly room for expansion, a little elbow room. But generally, I think people are really happy.
Just quickly, on land, a national monument is almost an invitation for tourists to take to the road and actually go see these places. Likely to happen in this case, even though they're so remote?
Not likely to happen because they are so remote. I think it's really hard to get out there. Most of these islands are actually uninhabited. And so even if you could get out there, they're volcanoes, essentially, by and large. And you could, you know, maybe pitch a tent if you're lucky, but basically you'd probably just stay on a boat. So they are way out there. They're really to protect the land for the creatures that live there, not much less for us to enjoy, except knowing that they're there should be a sense of enjoyment for us.
That's NPR's Richard Harris. Richard, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.